about it. That
I'm very relaxed, as you can tell. I've been stretching.
All right, mate. So, Mick, welcome to the ISS podcast, mate. Really glad you could come on. Really excited about this episode. Before I make the same mistake I do every single episode, I just want you to, if you can take us through your extensive career, mate, and give us a snapshot of who is Mick von Berg and why are we talking to him?
Good question. joined the army as a digger. Section Commander 1RAR, selected for Portsea, graduated as Second Lieutenant in December 1965, posted to 5 Battalion as a platoon commander, was on the advance party and with attached to 1RAR at Benoit for 4 weeks, 5 weeks, before the rest of the battalion got over. Then went into operations. I was originally platoon commander of 2 Platoon A Company. The company commander and I didn't see eye to eye about, how can I best describe it without being unkind because he's passed away, tactics in the field. And so he reported me for playing cards with the diggers. It was one way of getting rid of me. So they posted me up to anti-tank platoon. And, of course, I was sorry to lose my blokes from 2 platoon. They were a wonderful bunch of blokes. But it is what it is. And at that time, I had no idea what the CO and the OPSO and the 2IC were planning with the anti-tank platoon. After a period of time, the anti-tank platoon became the reconnaissance platoon, and I basically worked with 3 Squadron in country for 2 weeks down at Bung Tower, ran the guts out of them, me included, got a terrific bunch of blokes, wonderful, and because I knew all the NCOs because they're all ex-1RAR, I'd been on the piss with them, I'd played rugby with them, you know, but there was no sort of problems with familiarity, there was mutual respect. So reconnaissance platoon did a fantastic job, no question about it. And, of course, it was a great opportunity then for me to progress further within the SF field where I was posted to SAS. From SAS then I went to 2 Commando where I was the adjutant quartermaster and, of course, did a lot of I was a water baby, so I did an enormous amount of water work, training. And then from there went into, unfortunately, a staff appointment, ministerial investigations. Andrew Peacock was the minister at the time. So you can just imagine the sort of work that I was getting at that time. And from there, very pleasingly, posted back to 5 Battalion as the adjutant. And I was the adjutant for about 18 months. Peter Cosby, I resigned my commission. Whitlam got in November 72, probably one of the worst prime ministers we've ever had. He then proceeded to, a bit like Biden, decided to draw down the troops from Vietnam. He then decided to have Fortress Australia. And at the time, I had absolutely no ambition at all to be a member of a peacetime army. It's not my bag. I'm just too active, you know. So I resigned my commission in 72. I was removed as adjutant and Peter Cosgrove took my job as adj. And then I went down to D Company as acting company commander. And I thoroughly enjoyed that and, again, went on a couple of fairly major exercises with that company. And then Army took a while to get rid of me. I don't know why, but anyway, about 8 months later, they let me go. So that's sort of my military career in a bit of a snapshot.
That is, and reading your book that you're part of, and you're in a couple of books. But you gave, managed to get some research done in a couple of those chapters. And you know, there's some things that I really want to hit on here. And I think some of the young guys, especially because you're a bit famous in the RAR, circles for, because you go and present to all the recon courses and the advanced recon courses, and you're a bit of a legend. And I think the boys are really going to, enjoy having this to talk to and listen.
I don't know about a legend. I'm probably a troublemaker, not a legend.
So the first recon platoon was raised from you. You were part of raising that platoon.
Yeah. What happened was the edge. Well, it's a funny story. Dennis Rayner, who was a really good mate of mine, sadly he's now passed away. He's also an MC winner. After the bad time that we had up in the Nui Tibai Mountains, where I had my lengthy 3.5-4 hour contact, the CA decided to send the both of us off to Saigon with our brass band and with some diggers to march through Saigon for Vietnam National Day. And of course, Dennis and I saw this as a great opportunity to get up to some mischief, and which we did. But we didn't do it intentionally. We did it because we had to, because as we were lining up to march, you can imagine, you know, I mean, there was Americans, there was Vietnamese, there was Filipinos, there were Koreans, and a little old 5RAR with their brass band. And Dennis and I leading the march. Dennis was 6 months senior to me, so he was in front and I was behind him. And the front of the march got mortared. And that was a bit of disconcerting, you know. I mean, it's not the sort of parade you normally want to participate in. Anyway, they halted the march and they must have found the bad guys. But sadly, some people were actually killed. Some Americans were killed. And so when the march was over, Dennis and I really had to partake in some serious elixir to calm our nerves, shall I say. And when I arrived back in the battalion, the CO left a message. He wanted to catch up with me, and I went up to his office, his tent, actually, and there was the CO, the OPSO, the 2IC, the IO, Professor Robert O'Neill, and, of course, the ADJ. And I thought, shit, this might not be good. You know?
deny.
Because Dennis and I had a great time, you know. There was no question about it. But I thought, my God, what have I done? Well, anyway, they sort of sat me down. It was like a fireside chat. Then they said, Mick, we'd like you to establish and lead a reconnaissance platoon. Well, I was just absolutely blown away. I was just absolutely chuffed. And so they explained to me why and how and everything else. But then after that, they left everything to me. And here I was, I'd only been graduated for 8 months as a second lieutenant. And I thought, well, I'm going to need some help here. So the CO made a phone call to 3 Squadron, and initially I thought, oh, gee, you know, meeting them on their turf might be a bit disconcerting, and especially, you know, here we are, a sort of an infantry battalion with a platoon going to do their job type thing. Anyway, look.
Were they quite cemented at that stage? Because '57 were they formed?
Oh, yeah, they were
battle hardened.
They were highly organised, strategic. Nothing like what we've got currently in Afghanistan. You know, kicking in doors at night. I mean, what a load of crap. So no, they were very strategic, long range. I mean, 30,000, 35,000 metres out. And of course, with my lot, or not my lot, our lot, we were not going to go further than between maybe 10 to 15, but certainly 10 was the optimum because it was in artillery range. And as you know, 10,000 metres in the jungle is a bloody long way. And if you get into trouble, it's going to take a long time for a company to come out and help you. So 10,000 metres was it. And when all that was explained to the SAS boys, and of course I knew a lot of the NCOs. A lot of the NCOs were ex-1RAR. So they could not have been more helpful, you know. So we went down to Bung Tau and we selected, we had 42 or 43 that volunteered. Thankfully, a great group of diggers from the anti-tank platoon volunteered, which I'd been in the ship with up on the Nui Tibis. And we worked hard. SAS couldn't have been better in terms of imparting things that we didn't know, like, for instance, the withdrawal, the contact withdrawals, a lot of the reconnaissance skills, observation, deduction, assumption, all that sort of stuff. So after a period of 2 weeks, full on, and a little bit of night training, but when we didn't do the night training, we all got on the piss. And the reason for that, that was my, you know, the best way to get to know someone, because these guys came from all over the battalion. They didn't know each other. And the best way to get to know one another is to get on the terms, right? Get to really know one another, relax with one another, respect for one another. But the next day at 5:30, 5 o'clock, out of bed, and we ran through the sand hills until they dropped, me included. So they knew they couldn't hang one on too serious because the next morning was going to be really, really hard for them. But that sort of, that period of time, and I know it's the old army, new army today wouldn't do that sort of stuff. They'd have me on the dry somewhere. That sort of, that camaraderie and the fun and the humour and getting to know one another, in my view, was what bonded that group of people together to be such a wonderful bunch of blokes. So we selected about 28, roughly. All the NCOs were all NCOs that I knew extremely well. And from there, I had to sort of, you know, basically send people back to the battalion. But there was no sort of personal abuse or bloody ridicule or making people broken and feeling bad, just explaining that they just weren't suitable and they'd go back to the battalion as better diggers, which they did. They definitely went back. And also a bit of a pat on the back for getting out of their comfort zone, having a bit of a crack, volunteering. So we then, you know, we were sort of so-called qualified. But really, we still had on our training wheels, you know. And for us, although SAS was extremely helpful, and, of course, I had the task of putting together all the logistics and the equipment and what we're going to carry, the size of the patrols and all that sort of stuff, SAS was totally supportive of my structure at that time. And, of course, then once we decided to get out and operate, a lot of the, if you like, knowledge and expertise was on the job training. And an important part of that was post-op, we'd always catch up in the digger's boozer, sit around a table and have a real good debrief, you know, what mistakes we made, what could we do better, how can we improve, all that sort of business. And of course, as the grog got worse, and you know, you got some really great ideas, and obviously I didn't adapt them. But at least people were listening, you know. People like to be listened to.
Yeah, and they feel like they've got some
ownership. They've got some ownership. So that's basically, you know, how the platoon operated. Initially, there was some scepticism from others in the battalion, but no other reason except, oh dear, you know. And there was always a risk that we'd lose a patrol, a five-man patrol. There was always a risk we'd lose a platoon because we operated in reconnaissance in force of about 18, where we basically went into some hot areas, no hotter than the rest of the battalion, but, you know, they were sort of enemy-occupied areas. And being out on your own like that, I mean, there's always a chance of, you know, hitting something bigger than you and you get into some serious trouble.
I mean, I suppose the buck stops with you, doesn't it, when you are the platoon commander, you know, on the ground. Like, company commanders are fair out of the way. You've got to make the decisions and, you know, what happens ultimately sits or doesn't sit with you.
Absolutely. And the thing, the interesting thing is that, why I found it so easy to slip into a company commander role later, you know, in my career, is that as a reconnaissance platoon commander with four patrols, three patrols out in different areas, with me being the command patrol of six and two radios, I was like a mini company commander. You know, and I don't say that egotistically, I say it realistically. I was almost like a little company commander controlling the patrols, controlling...
Well, the call signs there, aren't they? You're just upscaling, yeah.
And also calling in all our own supporting fire, artillery, airstrikes, chopper strikes. You know, we did all that ourselves. So, obviously, with the support of the battalion, but on the ground, we had to control it all. And that in normal circumstances, you know, is a company commander role. So it assisted me enormously in developing to that next level.
Yeah, I'm perplexed by how much the Army has changed from, you're talking about, you know, debriefs after patrol, having a couple of beers in the diggers mess. But you got moved on for gambling with the diggers. Where when we went to Afghan, you couldn't drink a drop of alcohol, but you could gamble as much as you, like people were doing $2,000 poker.
Yeah, oh, look, that worry. Like that. I didn't draw a pay all the time I was in Vietnam. I came back with a shitload of money. And not just from playing cards, but also we took a fair bit off the Americans, which was great. But I also backed the horses as well. And my 2IC, Major Stan Major, he was a mad punter. So he and I would always exchange tips and we had a bookmaker in the battalion. I ran a bit of a book for a while as well. And no, I didn't draw pay all the time I was in Vietnam. So I came back with a lot of money. And we used to play a game called Slippery Sam. Do you know Slippery Sam?
No.
Well, in one winning hand, I won $10,000, US dollars. One winning hand, playing against the Americans in the artillery units. So, you know.
And they're pretty good about it. When they cough up, like they honour their bets.
I'm sorry?
They'd honour their bets. They'd cough
yeah,
up.
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, no. We had no problem at all, you know. But just, it's one of those games where you go for the pot and you keep going for the pot and you keep going for the pot. And in this particular hand, I still remember as if it was yesterday, I had two kings and an ace. And the only thing that could beat me was an offsuit, like a two of clubs. If I didn't have a club in my hand, it could have beaten me. So I went for pot. And I think the pot was about 9,000 or 8,000 or some damn thing. So, yeah. That was our relaxation, you know. You couldn't do it you could still do it today, but it's a different army, you know. I don't criticise it because I'm very close to it, but it's just a different army, different time, different type of people, different characters, and I think a lot of characters have gone out of the army. A lot of characters aren't tolerated in the army anymore.
Do you? Yeah, I think that matters. Go, mate.
Do you get superstitious, Mick? Are you superstitious?
I won't say superstitious, but I do have, I talk about this actually on my reconnaissance courses. I do have a sixth sense. I do have a very strong sixth sense premonition, the third eye.
Mate, the reason I ask, I used to love losing I love a good punt. But when we're on ops overseas, I used to love losing. So I used to think that was me getting all my bad luck out of the way. And if I won too much, I'd be nervous that the next day you're going to blow up. But winning 10 grand, that obviously didn't make you lose any sleep.
No. It was one of those days where, my cards just fell right, you know?
Yeah, good. Mate, on that, you're a guy who's been in commander troops in war zones overseas. How important did you think, and I know times are changing, but how important do you think it was to take your team out and have a few beers for bonding before, as when they first get to know each other?
I think it was crucial. But the thing is that at that particular time, our battalion had already been operating for a while. All of my diggers were fighting fit. You know, they'd been on hard rations for bloody months. Yes, they'd have booze when they came back in after ops, but they were fit, they were keen, but they were from all parts of the battalion and people didn't know each other. And I think the best way to get to know one another and sit down and have a bit of a laugh and exchange some pleasantries and get to know people in terms of personalities and character and is this the sort of guy that's going to look after my back? The only way to do that is over a jar. And that's what we did. We did every night. We didn't do night training. And the SAS blokes are with us, you know, like, because they were doing the night training with us. And if we didn't have night training, oh, we all went out in the piss. And it just made a huge difference in terms of the camaraderie and the understanding and the respect between people before we actually went out on ops. I don't think we could have done it within that sort of 2-week period that we had, which was full on in terms of training. It was full on. I don't think we would have had the cohesion, the understanding, the respect, and the communication between people unless we had actually enjoyed each other's company over a few beers.
Mate, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's one of the things that the younger generations are missing massively. I mean, in a 24-hour period, you can take a group of people who never met each other out on the piss, bonding, find out who you, I mean, you can do personality assessments on everyone in your team when you've got a few cans under their belt, and then getting them to the point where they're going to have a bit of a hangover, getting them up early, do a bit of shared suffering, go and do some arduous activities the next morning within 8 to 10 hours, you've got everyone to bond and you've identified the weak and strong points within your team. I think that's one thing we need to bring back.
Yeah, well, in my case, what I had to do is I had to make some hard calls, you know, who was in, who was out. And, of course, before we made those calls, we and the SAS guys are on the terps with us. We've been able to make some assessments, you know, and one of the things, because I then later on in SAS, I ran 3 selection courses as a second lieutenant. And one of the most important things that I used to look for was character. The character of the individual, the integrity of the individual, the ability to communicate and work as a team. You know, lots of the other things we can teach them later. But if a person doesn't have character, and by character, I mean a real inner strength and character and spirit. If a person hasn't got that, it doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean they're bad people, but they might be the sort of people that you really don't need in a tough spot. And it's that character assessment that I think is very important. And even later in life, I mean, when I went into the commercial world, I mean, for me, if it was a salesperson I was putting on somewhere, he or she may not have been, you know, the more experienced or competent salesperson. But if I thought the guy was sincere or the lady was sincere and had character and was willing to learn and willing to work hard, they got the nod. Sometimes we seem to go for the prima donnas, and it's the prima donnas quite often that let you down. You guys would have found that. You get them everywhere. You get them everywhere. You know, the hotshot bloody NCO. He's bloody wonderful on the hills up behind Townsville. But when he's on the two-way rifle range, all of a sudden things change.
Yeah, it was funny. When Monaro was getting ready to go on MRTF2, was that Arch? I fucking can't remember.
Yeah, that was us.
Mate, I'm going to be in a pickle in 20 years. They'll be calling me. They'll be like stolen valor. Like, I can't remember for fuck. There were people that it was really interesting to see people that went missing and just said, look, you know, it's not really my cup of tea. I don't really want to deploy to Afghan. We're like, why the fuck did you join the Army, mate?
Exactly. I couldn't wait to go away.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I couldn't wait. For me, look, I've played a lot of rugby. I've coached rugby. And I mean, up behind me here, I've got a photograph of Fire Battalion, undefeated, no tries against. And the bloke in the back row is Peter Cosgrove. And I'm the captain coach of the side, you know? And in that sort of a situation, again, it's the same thing. You know, you just have some blokes that just absolutely put their body on the line and have no fear whatsoever. And you get some that are just a bit gun-shy. But that doesn't make them bad people. It just means they've got different background, different ways of being brought up. They might be a bit sensitive. They might just be a bit soft. But it doesn't make them bad people. It's just that not the sort of people I want around me when they're actually on active service, not in the bush in a reconnaissance role. And all the SAS blokes, I mean, when I was running the selection courses in SAS, we'd have a board of studies, which was the last sort of selection of who was in and who was out. And one of the questions I used to ask all the NCOs, and I had some great, I mean, sergeants and warrant officers, terrific NCOs with a lot of experience, and I'd say, would you take Private Jones? I never used to use numbers. I hate this numbers thing. It dehumanises people. So I used to say, would you take Private Jones or Sapper Jones on patrol? And we go around the table and everybody would say, yes, 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 and suddenly one guy would say, no, probably not. And then we'd say, well, please explain. Tell us why. And he may have seen something in that person that we all didn't pick up. But then we discuss it and we thought, well, it's hardly sort of a mark for failure. But at least we can counsel the individual and say, mate, you're through, but you've got to work on this, that type of thing. Mm. So again, I think the ability to read people, the ability to look at people's character, I think is just so important.
What was the pass rates back then? Because they were quite, I mean, when I was 20, early 2000s, it was six or eight, maybe 12 out of a
course. Yeah, well, I'd get roughly around about 45 to 50 and five would pass. Yeah.
Oh, that's why the CSAS.
They were hard courses. They were hard courses, but there was none of this sort of stuff that I hate watching this bloody SAS Channel 7 thing. It really makes me angry, you know? You don't have to bloody eyeball people this far away from their nose and abuse them. I mean, it's just bullshit. It's just absolute bullshit. So, yeah, no, they were hard courses, physically very hard. I put through quite a few officers who then went on to senior rank and especially in charge of SOCOM. But, you know, at the time, you know, I was guided by my NCOs. You got to listen to your NCOs. And if somebody wasn't up to it, they weren't up to it. I mean, a lot dropped out because of the physical. And they weren't sort of stupid physical things. Like, you know, doing push-ups on gravel with your knuckles. It was bloody hard patrolling, you know, sleep deprivation, 72 hours of no sleep patrolling or just a long, hard slog, you know, and some really hard hill climbing. But, you know, some people just couldn't handle it. So you just quietly pull them aside and you quietly chat to them and say, well, mate, you're struggling, aren't you? And he'd say, yeah, I am, sir. I'd say, what do you want to do? He said, well, you know, I just don't think I can go on. He'd say, well, thanks very much for coming and good luck back in the battalion because you'll go back a better person. So put them on the train in those days and they'd probably drink a lot of grog on the way home, but they go back to either Holsworthy or Enoggera. You know, we only had four battalions initially. So, you know, I think that whole thing of working with people under pressure, understanding people under pressure, respecting people under pressure. We all react different ways. You know, we're not a clone of something. We all react different ways, and and you basically just have to harness all that together as a commander or as a leader and get the best out of them.
Yeah, because, I mean, speaking specifically to that, you, your experiences on Operation Queanbeyan, was that your first time in a, that was your first contact,
no,
was it?
No, no, we had I had contacts with 2 Platoon, A Company.
Yep.
But
this was the bloody, reading that chapter, that sounded like an absolute nightmare terrain.
It was just, besides losing a really good man, which really upset me, he was a Torres Strait Islander, married with 4 kids, section commander. But when you don't know where the enemy are, you have no idea where they are. You're on a mountain face with a gradient of 1 in 2, large rocks and trees and root systems. And, you know, one of the things in a firefight, you've got to be able to control your men. You've got to know where they are, you know. And trying to do that, but at the same time also trying to identify where the bad guys are. And it was just so hard. It was just so hard. And everybody on the mountain that day just fought magnificently. They really did. It was just amazing. But, not something I'd like to go through again, put it that way.
The description of the terrain and just knowing, I guess, getting into contact has its own pressures that you put on because you're like, holy fuck, here we go. But I couldn't imagine doing it in close country like that jungle, like described in that chapter of Crossfire, and what you must have gone through. That would be, a nightmare. How long it took you? What, 3.5?
Three and three quarter hours, roughly. It was just the terrain was unimaginable. You just cannot understand the terrain unless you've actually been in it and seen it. And, you know, a gradient of 1 and 2s like that, you know, it's very steep and rocks and boulders. Anyway, the bottom line is that once we had cleared it, we found stacks of caves that were booby-trapped, and that's above my pay grade. So we called in the sappers and the pioneers, and they then went into this cave system. Well, the reason the enemy was so determined to dislodge us, if you like, and the thing that really frightened them were the 2 US gunships that we called in, who fired their rockets straight down into the tunnels. We found a lot of blood, bandages and all that sort of stuff. But the reason they were so determined not to give in too easily, it was the headquarters of the deputy commander of 274 North Vietnamese Regiment. And later on, D Company, who were commissioned to clear the tunnels with the sappers, they discovered the radio of the deputy commander plus his logbook. And in discussing it with Bob O'Neill over the years, and Bob is just a wonderful individual, he was our IO, and he then, a brilliant mind, you know, he was a Rhodes Scholar when he came to us, and he then went on to Oxford University as a professor of history of war, and he reckons it's one of the most important discoveries that we'd made on our tour of Vietnam, not just Fire Battalion, the task force, because this, you've got to remember, this was post Long Tan. It was October, Long Tan was August. So you could just see in the logbook all of the build-up and all the stuff which had been ignored by the task force, I might add, task force headquarters, and you could just see all this build-up and that sort of information and also future operations and where they'd been and, you know, contacts and losses and all that sort of stuff. That was invaluable int for the task force.
Yeah, I understand. Because I didn't think they were using they brought flamethrowers up and stuff. You still used flamethrowers in Vietnam.
John McAloney, the late John McAloney, who was a wonderful mate of mine. I was his best man when he got married. He wanted MC on the same operation 2 days after me. where he had to dislodge some bad guys with a flamethrower. And that's scary stuff too, you know. Sadly, we lost a couple of guys from Assault Pioneers at that time, booby traps and shooting. And so to dislodge them, John got one of his flamethrowers and took them on and scorched them.
I like your choice of words there, mate. I don't know if there's many people out there that would assume you use a flamethrower as a dislodging tool, but it did the job.
I'll tell you what, it dislodged me.
Mate.
I just want to sorry.
No, okay. No, you go, Max. You go.
I'm just curious, like the impact of, I mean, 70s. I honestly think people were harder back then. And I think soldiers were definitely harder. And that was a product of the environment and what Australia was. I think soldiers are smarter now to a degree, but they're probably a little softer. Do you know, if not meaning any offense, if you can follow my meaning, but I'm just wondering, like the thought of, you know, using flamethrowers on people or in contact in jungles. What was going through your mind when all this sort of stuff was happening and your coping mechanisms? And did you know this stuff was happening to you? Cause I know it wasn't very prevalent coming back home. People, what was going through your mind coming back home or dealing with this sort of stuff?
Yeah, look, I mean, I talk a lot to young fellas and in the battalions. And at the School of Infantry, this is all pre-COVID, of course. Now you're sort of restricted a bit, but I've got nothing but admiration for our young people. I just think they're fantastic. And you're right, they certainly are smarter, right? But that doesn't mean they're street smarter. They're smarter academically. They're smarter in terms of perhaps being able to absorb quicker than what we were. But what I do find, and it's not a criticism, purely an observation, is that I think in my time, and when I say my time, our time, my blokes, our blokes, we're more resilient. And that's not a criticism of young people of today. I think it's basically who we are, how we were raised, what we had in our lives, whether it was families or money or no money or a dysfunctional family or whatever the case might be, I just think that we just seem to be a bit more resilient. Like, in other words, if it turns to shit, it's not the end of the world. You pick yourself up and have another go. You know, I mean, if you're knocked down in a bit of a bloody pub fight or something, you get up and hit him back. You know, it's just a different mindset. And today I just don't think people are as resilient. And the reason that I don't think they're as resilient is because of the way they've been brought up. And that's not a criticism of their family or anything else. It's the way they've been brought up in a different social norm. Times have changed, you know. And people today, and that's why I really enjoy talking to young soldiers, they come up with some pretty good bloody questions. You know, in my day, I mean, you wouldn't dare question a company commander or a platoon commander. You'd sort of, well, if that's what he wants to do, that's what we do, you know. So I just think that it's we're all creatures. We're all creatures of our environment. And the environment that we were in, and myself in particular, was a pretty tough environment. And because of that tough environment, it basically made you overall more resilient. Now, however, you can be more resilient, but you can still suffer with PTSD. And I've got chronic PTSD. I admit it to people. I talk about the subject quite openly. But the key is, for me at least anyway, is to know what your triggers are, avoid those triggers, and if one of those triggers is activated, like I haven't slept very well in the last 2 or 3 days because of the Afghan situation. And when I say, you know, I go to bed sort of 9:30, 10, and I'm up at 3 because my head's going at 100 miles an hour. And I think to be able to manage the condition, once that there is a trigger, you've got to have a coping mechanism yourself from within to be able to cope with that without drugs. And certainly booze doesn't help either, you know. So I think we all came home with our garbage, you know what I mean? We all came home with it. And I think the real issue with the Vietnam blokes is the way they were treated when they came home. And that's why we feel for our blokes today, you know, with this bloody Biden fiasco in the States and then Afghanistan. Denigrate war, don't denigrate the soldier.
Absolutely.
All of our blokes have performed admirably. But we were there. I'm just writing an article, actually. We were there too long. I mean, you know, we were there in October 2001, straight after September 9/11. It took us 10 years, when I say us, the alliance, it took us 10 years to bloody wipe out bin Laden. And then what's the next thing to do? Right, that was the whole thing, to go over there, bin Laden, make sure there's no more training camps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, we knew the Taliban were friends with Al-Qaeda. But then all of a sudden we got into mission creep. And you're trying to nation build a country with 9 different ethnic groups and 200 tribes who have absolutely no allegiance to Kabul. Their allegiance is to their village and their village chief, full stop. And that's it. And you've got some ethnic groups within the country that won't talk to each other. So how the hell are we going, how's the Americans going to nation build? Yes. You know, we're part of it, you know. So, but notwithstanding that criticism, our blokes, they should never think that it wasn't worthwhile. It's the same with me, Vietnam. Vietnam made me a better person, and I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I would not have missed it. Mm. Yes, there might have been some psychological damage post-Vietnam, but it hasn't harmed me to the point where I'm not functioning, and it hasn't harmed me to the point where I think what I did was wrong. Mm. We did what we had to do. Once you sign on, you swear an allegiance to the crown. And if the government today said that's where you go, that's where you go. So with our young people, you know, young males and females who serve today, 35,000 of them have served in Afghanistan, I take my hat off to them and I'm proud to be standing in their midst. I really am.
Mate, I couldn't agree more. Regardless of the outcomes, I think they were my formative years in the Army, and things that happened overseas, good or bad or otherwise, made me exactly who I am today. And I mean, I don't have another version to compare it to, but I wouldn't want to change any of that.
No. Well, look at the work you guys are doing. You know what I mean? You wouldn't be doing that if you didn't come back from Afghanistan better people. And in my case, I know for a fact, I mean, I was a bit of a smart ass before I went because I was a jockstrap. You know, I played rugby straight out of Kapooka for the Army, into service. I swam for the Army. I played water polo for the Army. I boxed, athletics. You know, I was a real jockstrap. And, you know, because you're operating at that sort of jockstrap level, you think you're a bit better than what you really are. And then once the shit starts to hit the fan in Vietnam, you start to realise, you know what, these bullets don't sort of just knock off diggers. You know, there's no rank discrimination in the field. You sort of think, okay, you know, come down a bit, be a bit more modest, be a bit more humble, you know. And that's where I think Vietnam for me, and my blokes kept me honest, you know, really. My blokes kept me honest, you know. If I said something and it was, you know, it was off the wall stuff, oh, come on, Skip, what are you talking about? You know? So I think that whole experience and the wonderful people I had the pleasure of serving with, including my fellow officer corps, you know, it just made me all round a far better person. And that's why I would have never missed it. I would have never missed it. I would, if I hadn't have gone, I'd probably still be the same prick I was before I went to Vietnam, you know.
Yeah. No, mate, a lot of what you're saying, I mean, there's a few points there. I don't want to gloss over any of it, but and we can come back to any of them. But a lot of what you said resonates with the identity message that we kind of try and unpack a lot, in that knowing, having a strong sense of who you are and having a solid identity is fundamental to having positive mental health. And you're talking about resilience for a minute. And I think there is a resilience issue with younger generations at the moment.
Yeah.
What that is, I mean, it's complex, there's a lot to it, but I think it's got a lot to do with there is no rites of passage anymore, and younger people have no clue when they look in the mirror who they are. And if you don't know who you are, you can't identify your strong kind of fundamental values. You don't have that motivation to get you off the ground when you get knocked down. And that's a big part of resilience. Do you think that is – was that the same in your generation? Did you have – let me frame this properly. When you were a young bloke, obviously completely different life experience to us in your pre-military career, do you think you had a stronger sense of identity than the young kids these days?
I had to. I had to have that. I'll tell you why, because I'm a Kraut. I was born in Germany, you know, and I went to an Irish Catholic school. So you just imagine, you wonder why I can fight. and
that's right, because you immigrated straight.
Not a world leader, but you know, as I said earlier, if you're knocked down, you get up. So I think, I made a lot of mates at school. No question about that. But you know, because of your background, you're a new Australian. You're a Wog. You're a Bolt. You're a Hitler. You get all this stuff at school. Bullying, you know, because you get all of that, and it was in a fairly tough sort of time in the world, 1950, 51, 52, there was more resilience in young people, I think. And in those days too, you've got to remember, a lot of the males in the household had come back from World War II.
Mm.
So which can be good or bad, you know. I mean, a lot of those poor buggers might have had serious PTSD, you know. And we all know that there was a lot of alcohol and domestic violence and all that sort of stuff. But they would have brought up, I would think, their children a lot tougher. And I don't mean, you know, cruelty or abuse or anything like that. Just, you know, like you get knocked down, you get up. And in my case, you know, sort of delivering newspapers at 4 o'clock in the morning, -4 degrees, off a push bike, to make something like, I don't know, 2 shillings and 6 pence pocket money. You know, it's just a different world that we live in.
Mm.
And it's the technology, it's the information that people are getting. And I think now, sadly, with a lot of young people, it's what are you gonna do for me? And that's why I like Kennedy saying, you know, not what your country can do for you, it's what you can do for your country. You know, I think
that's what you're starting to see a lot, especially with this Afghan stuff. I like to go and talk about, like, the recent news is that I know we can get drawn into it and people are trying to deep dive and figure out why we were there and was it, you know, like, you just have to. Sometimes you can simplify and say, we served, like you said before, we joined and the crown says you're going here for queen and country. Yeah. Off you go. And that's what you did. And that's what happened. And when they say it's time to come home, it's time to come home. And I just think that people now with such access to information and they start drawing their own conclusions, you know, you can get away from you, can't it? Without that framework of who I am. I mean, I guess, the church was probably a bit around in back in your time and gave you that strict railroad, I suppose, that allowed for some COVID.
Yeah, look, I think also, I think in people that have strong character and who are resilient, I think there's a certain spirituality in them. And I don't necessarily mean God per se. I don't necessarily mean religion, although I'm a liberal Catholic, you know. But I think an inner strength, a spirituality within, is something that should be in all of us. And I just question how hard people work to try and find that. And the best way to find it, I mean, you know, if I'm having a bad day, you know, we all have bad days. You know, something goes pear-shaped, and we live on the water here. I just get in my car, put my little deck chair in the back, go down to the beach, get the chair out, quietly sit there, look out over the ocean, and meditate. Just get the shit out of your head. You know, I mean, air is free. You're taking in big breaths of air, and you know, there's nothing finer psychologically than the breathing in fresh ocean air. You know, it is just so therapeutic and relaxing. So you're quietly sitting there, and you're not meditating like, you know, some of the Buddhists and humming and all that sort of stuff. You're just quietly sitting there, you're reflecting, and you're resetting. And that comes from within.
Absolutely.
That comes from within. It's not something that somebody can sort of switch on and off in you. It comes from within. And I think that's sort of, that is spirituality. And I think a lot of good people have a lot of spirituality within. You know, what's right and what's wrong? What's ethical and what's moral? What isn't moral? And I don't mean moral in terms of a prudish thing. I mean moral in terms of what is right and what is wrong, you know. And we've all got a moral compass. I'd like to think we all have a moral compass. And I think it's that moral compass and that spirituality, and it's who we are. That's why the inquiry, IGADF inquiry, you know, upset me a bit. Because yes, there are allegations. Yes, I think it's been handled badly. No question about it. But, notwithstanding, they are serious allegations. It's not who or what we are as a nation. It's not who or what we are as people. We don't do that. We just don't do that. So the investigation has to run its course. But, you know, moral compass, morals and ethics in warfare, very important. Very important, because the boot can be on the other foot.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they start talking about we talk about moral injury now, and I think it's been absconded. I think this is probably opening a can of worms for DBA. We spoke about this. But they're talking about moral injury. So they're saying, okay, you know, and I want to sort of go into the tribe stuff about when you come home from Vietnam and the acceptance back into society. But before that, we talk about there were so many PTSD claims coming through, and then saying, well, there's probably only in Afghan, there was probably only 10% of the army that got into a contact. But we're seeing PTSD rates upward of 38% and things like this. So DVA is like, what the fuck is going on? Is everyone just got PTSD? Like, so they started looking back and trying to do the right thing. They're like, maybe there's this moral injury stuff. And Adrian can probably talk to this a little bit better. But then it's just opened up another can of worms for,
for
taking the system.
They didn't know what moral injury was until I raised it about 5 years ago. And I've been very fortunate in attending some wonderful lectures from a Professor Sherman from the US. She actually teaches morals and ethics at Annapolis to the SEAL teams. And she's wrote a wonderful book called After War. And she's actually, believe it or not, she's actually an anthropologist before she is a psychiatrist or psychologist.
They're the best ones, mate. They're the best ones.
Yeah, if you get a copy of the book, you read it, or I'll send you on email the cover. You can buy it through Amazon. It goes right through to the days of the Trojans, the days of the Spartans, the days of the Huns, the Picts, you know, and things like moral injury is not new. Things like PTSD is not new, you know, but moral injury can mean so many different things to different people. And that's why, at the moment through the Phoenix organisation in Melbourne, they're really trying to get their head around it, you know, and a lot of people are seriously morally injured. You know, if you say something that you know is wrong and you live with it, you live with it for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the research that I've seen, it focuses a lot on witnessing certain events, knowing you could have interacted and didn't, or failure to do what you knew was right at the time. And that is, I mean, textbook, that's fantastic. What I'm worried about is DVA getting overwhelmed with claims over the next decade, not from moral injury that occurred overseas, but from the what appears to be moral injury because people went overseas, just went over there, not about actions or events that happened, but just went over there and then came back to a country where the media is just on repeat saying we shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is obviously both Vietnam and
absolutely. And
shouldn't have been there. You're killing innocent people, blah, 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 blah. None of which is true. I mean, very, very minute amounts of that would be true. But the moral injury, I believe, can develop post that, looking back over time, going, what if my memories of what I did 10 years ago in the Middle East were not 100% accurate? And all I'm seeing for the following 10, 15, 20 years is what the media making out that the entire country is against me. I mean, that A plays into your identity piece, like I said before. It makes you question what your own morals are, but then it can induce or bring on the symptoms and signs of moral injury because people start to believe they did something wrong just by being there. And that's something we've got to get out of the media.
And you can blame the media for that. You know, I've got
absolutely
the bloody media, they've got a lot to answer for. A lot to answer for. And we had it, you know, been called baby killers and all that sort of business. And yes, it did have an effect. And moral injury is that, you know, I mean, you could have been, an ordnance chap, on the beach at 1ALSG in Bung Tau doing a good job. You know, I mean, if we didn't have those blokes, we wouldn't get our rations, you know, so doing a good job, but then the poor bugger comes home. And everybody's abusing it.
Mm.
I mean, that's moral injury, you know. But the moral injury also is in the serving army is things like abuse of young female soldiers, sexual abuse, bullying, intimidating, all that sort of business. That's moral injury too. So it's an interesting subject, but I found the lectures from Professor Sherman, and then reading her book, I found it fascinating. It really, really explains it very, very well. And it's not new. It's been going on. It's been something that's been there for thousands of years.
I think this has a lot to do. Sebastian Junger's book on Troy, and he started breaking down. They talk about the lack of psychological emissions during the bombings of London went down. Psychological trauma and PTSD things when the whole of society was unified went down. So World War One vets coming home, the whole world went to war, right? World War Two, the whole war. Vietnam, only a very specific group of people went. And when they come back, instead of coming back to their tribe, their Indian tribe that everyone's been, they were outcast and ostracized and abused. And I think that was, I think it's absolutely massive. And talking about watching the stuff on the embassy, I just really don't want these things to happen. Like, we should have learned from the Vietnam vets, and they've done so much in paving the way for veterans. I don't want us to go back 50 fucking years and do the same shit all over again.
Look, we should learn from history. You know, we should learn from history, not ignore it. And it's not like, you know, old Vietnam farts like me telling warriors. It's not warriors at all. It's, mate, this is how it affected me. This is what I did to manage it. And it wasn't pour me, pour me, pour me another drink. You know, it was some steps that I took and others took to be able to manage those, if you like, negative comments, you know. But even with even trying to manage it, I mean, it's on your hard drive. It's back there in your subconscious. You can't avoid it. And that's why, you know, our young people today who come back from Afghanistan and now with this chaos and fiasco that's going on, everything they tried to do, everything they tried to fight for, yes, it looks like it's collapsed, but that's not their fault. They have done an outstanding job. I just know so many of the battalions, and SF, of course, but the battalions who did an outstanding job over there. And our combat engineers, you know. So I just think we, all of us, current veterans, and in particular Vietnam veterans, we've got to basically embrace the young people, communication-wise at least, you know, embrace them and say, guys, we've been there, we feel your pain, but let's get on with life. Let's move forward, you know. And I think that's what has to happen. Otherwise, it'll be victimhood forever. And victims don't have a very good life, you know.
Nope, absolutely.
We're all warriors, you know. We're all warriors, and we should be thinking like warriors and behaving like warriors and talking like warriors and being positive and getting on with life and doing something rather than poor me, you know. I mean, that is where people get damaged. They basically isolate themselves, watch the porn channel, drink a lot of grog, knock on DBA's door and expect to be looked after. Now, if it's qualified service and a justifiable claim, fantastic, go for it. But you've got to do something else with your life. You can't just, you know, sit around and do nothing. You've got to get on with your life.
Yeah, I mean, there's statistics now that they say people who sit on a pension and don't go out and find meaningful purpose in their life, it is a 10-year death sentence.
No question about it. Yeah. I mean, you've got to have purpose and you've got to have meaning in your life. And I found in my particular case, what I found was wonderful therapy for me, believe it or not, was helping others. Peer-to-peer support.
It's the best out there, mate.
It is the best therapy out there. You know, I counsel people. I don't have any qualifications to counsel people. I'm not a social worker. I'm not a shrink. But I speak from lived experience. And if there's another person there who's a fellow platoon commander of mine that's, you know, or a young digger, a corporal, you know, well, I've been there. I've been a section commander. I've commanded section commanders. I know what your problem is. I know where you're struggling. I know how you're struggling. Let's talk about it. Let's get it out. Don't hold back. You want to cry? Bloody cry. I'll cry with you. And just basically get people to sort of open up and be honest with themselves. You know, I think it's just so important. I think it is so important. And the important thing there, of course, is you've got to have somebody that you really trust that you can talk to. Trust is peer-to-peer support is all about trust. And you know, if I've got a problem, with all due respect, I don't want to talk to a sergeant cook, or I don't want to talk to an ordnance corps bloke. You know, not denigrating ordnance corps. I mean, but we've got nothing in common. Or a CPO from a Navy. We've got nothing in common. I want to talk to a bloke that's done what I've done. Or a platoon sergeant that is able to talk to a platoon sergeant. And an infantry at least anyway, so that you're all speaking the same language. And you've all got that mutual trust and respect. And you get an enormous amount out of that. And I've found that in terms of the sort of counselling I've done, one-on-one, is that when you really open up, when they really open up and you've got their trust, and whatever they tell me is absolutely sacrosanct, you know, goes no further. When they really tell me what the issue is, you then start to pull out some stops around the place to see what you can do to help. And I found, you know, with a guy that's really struggling or a young lady, that's really struggling, and you're able to just sow a couple of seeds, just a couple of seeds, and say, go there, try this, or have a go at this. And all of a sudden, they realise that there is somebody there that cares for them. There's somebody there that wants to help them. There's somebody there that loves them, you know. And I don't mean love in an improper way, you know. The love of fellow human being. And, you know, if you're able to get to people in that way, providing they're prepared to listen and providing they're prepared to open up, and that's the hardest. Initially, there's a bit of standoff, you know. What's this dickhead know? You know, that sort of thing. But once you're able to sort of really talk to them in a very frank and open manner and convince them that there is life and there is a future, and life is just so great, you know. Yes, the world's fucked up at the moment, but I'll tell you what, individually, my family, my group of friends, my rugby mates, my military mates, life's good. The worst thing you can do is isolate yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. Mate, you are ticking all the boxes. Yeah. You're basically selling Swiss 8 for us. I think you've just broken every stereotype people have about Vietnam vets. And the last 10 minutes, everything you've said, you're almost the most enlightened person we've spoken to on the podcast. And this is coming from a bloke who fought in the Vietnam War. Who I guess, sorry.
Bit of a stall there, mate.
Yeah, he'll still be
right. Sorry, I missed some of that.
Did I drop out for a second? I was just saying, mate, this is one of the most enlightened conversations we've had in a while, and it's breaking stereotypes, I think, for what people assume is a Vietnam vet. And the stereotype is that Vietnam vets have got a 1,000-yard stare, they drink themselves to sleep, and that's about all that's going on in life. And everything you just said is 100% how people should be living their lives.
Yeah. No, look, I think there are some that still have that 1,000-yard stare, no question about it. But there are so many others, and I've got the utmost respect for our national servicemen. Just think about it. You're working in Westpac, you go home, your marbles are been called out, you're on the train to Kapuka or to Pakapunyal, you're doing your recruit training, and 6 months later you're in the jungles of Vietnam. You then do your stunt over there, you come home, you get off the plane, and on the Monday you're back in the bank. I mean, how did these young people cope with that? And in my platoon, I had 50% national service, and just wonderful blokes, you know, just wonderful blokes. So many of them had to get on with their lives. Because the time they had in the army, the 2 years, was almost like a sort of a two-year holiday, according to their employer.
Yeah.
And the employer that had that was part of the rules, you know. But a lot of them went on and became top blokes in the banking system, in the insurance system, lawyers. I know about a half a dozen lawyers. One of them, my blokes, is a professor of marketing. You know, a lot of them got on with their lives. But I think some people just struggled because I just don't think they've had the willpower, or I don't think they've had the influence around them, a kick up the butt to get on with their lives. Sometimes you've got to have, you've got to be cruel to be kind. Sometimes you just say, mate, get on with it. You know, don't worry about that. Get on with it. And that is either motivation or just a kick up the butt, you know, because we're all different.
Absolutely.
I can't believe this. I'm a bit blown away. I mean, I just reading the book and seeing the face value, I thought, you know, the conversation would be drawn towards, you know, the glaring obvious ones that, you know, but the depth and knowledge, that you, I'm a bit blown away, mate. Absolutely.
Well, I suppose, part of my, PTSD therapy was rugby. Because once you cross that line, mate, you can really square up, you know? You can really get into it, get rid of your frustrations, get rid of your anger, get rid of whatever you're carrying, whatever baggage you're carrying, and play a good, hard game of rugby. And then when I sort of stopped playing, I then took up more coaching. And in coaching, for me, it was almost like being the platoon commander again. You know, you got 18 blokes, 15 blokes on the park at any one time, and we'd have four or five reserves. And, you know, again, you're working with young people, you're trying to teach them, you're trying to motivate them, stimulate them, mother them at times, etc. And then they go into a contact situation, which is a game of rugby. You then pull them back after the game over a few beers, have a bit of a debrief, what we do right, what we do wrong. And the next week you start again. Training Tuesday and Thursday, playing Saturday. Now that for me, that was therapy for me. I did it for years. That was therapy. But then, you know, I got all the way to a director of the Australian Rugby Union. I was on the board of the ARU. Today I'm still president of our union here in South Australia. You pull back and you go into a more sort of sedate type role. And then I thought, you know, another institution that's been very good to me is the Army. What can I do? I've done all the rugby stuff. I did that all over the world. I've had fun, you know. Then I thought when I came back from overseas and I stopped most of my rugby sort of playing, coaching activities, I thought, what can I do now? So I joined the RAR Association. I've always been a member of the Fire Battalion Association, SAS Association, Commando Association. And when I came back and stopped all the rugby activity, I thought, well, where else can I get involved? Where else can I put something back to either an institution or a game? Army's not a game, but what else can I do? And that's where I then, about 15 years ago, got involved more with Army and with veterans on a more formal basis. With my own blokes from Recce Platoon, Fire Battalion, we've been in touch for over 54 years. You know, we're always in touch. We communicate by email, or, you know, we all know when somebody's passed away or when someone's struggling, and we all get on the phone, help one another, you know. So I've always had that relationship, plus also with my battalion and with my fellow officers, I've always had that relationship. But in terms of broader assistance and broader knowledge to help where you can, I just thought, well, let's get back into an organisation, notwithstanding that Mr. Whitlam and all that crap, get back into an organisation that's been very good for me. And the Army has been very good for me, no question about it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, because this is something would be actually really good to see when we talk about the transition piece, because you are the president of the RAR Corporation. Yeah. And this is something that I think is really important, is that people, the associations have dropped off a little bit, and I know we're building them up, and this is so important. I think the people that transition out of the Army should walk straight into their associations, be part of that, keep that camaraderie, build that knowledge up, build that base up, because and then, you know, if you want to go and meet up in the RSL, that's fine. But I think the point of truth should be the association.
Yeah, look,
go and join your bloody association.
With the RAR Association or Corporation, I'm the chair and national president. Our members are the battalion associations. And at this time, we still have our merged battalions, obviously, on there. But I think every person who separates from their battalion or from the Army should, if they're a regimental person, should join their battalion association. And the reason I say that is twofold. One, staying in touch with people with whom they served and having that connection, which I think is important both spiritually and mentally. And the other one is that as far as the work that we do, like the board of the corporation, the work that we do is really strictly policy. And it's policy at a senior level, dealing with ministers and DBA and defence. Now, we don't have any executive power in policy, but we have an influence. And the best way to get that influence is to get maximum input and feed from the battalion associations. And then once you're talking to a politician, the only thing politicians understand is numbers. If I'm Billy the Goose and I go and see my local poly and I'm just a number is one, yes, I'll be politely dealt with and listened to, and but once I go, that's it. But if I'm dealing on behalf of over 100,000 extended families, I am listened to. And I don't mean that egotistically, I mean it realistically. If they know that your association, which is the RAR Association, is representing something like 100,000 plus, which it is, and these days, because a veteran is considered anybody that's had more than one day full-time service, by default, our members are also serving members of the battalion. So, you know, I think to be able to be in a position, in a stronger position to advocate and try and influence policy, you know, our numbers are so important because our numbers come through the battalion associations, and that's where I think the young people, the battalion association should work more actively and get young people to join up. And it's not a huge cost, you know, I mean, $40 a year or something, you know, but that means they're still part of the tribe. They're still there, you know, and I just think that is so important for young people because that separation and separation anxiety is not good during transition. And if we can have more people at least operating at that level, it means it makes it far easier, not necessarily easier, but it gives us more credence at that senior level as to saying, look, you know, we think that this is not quite right, or have you thought about this, or have you thought about that? And we do this through a DBA. And again, we have no executive power or authority. All we can say to DBA from time to time is, look, we think this is wrong and this is why. And more importantly, this is a recommended solution. You know, just bloody sitting there and throwing barbs all the time doesn't do you any good. I think you've got to come up with a solution and say, look, we think this is wrong. This is why we think it's wrong. And this is a potential solution. And then it's up to them to decide whether it's something they want to take up or not.
Mate, I couldn't agree more. And sorry, I'm going to have to shoot in a minute. I've got to pick the kids up, but I'm loving what we're talking about. I've got a question. How can younger diggers get more involved with their battalion association? Because everything you've just said is 100% correct. And I think our generation, the biggest flaw in our generation, especially around infantry units, is we just don't stay connected to our tribe when we leave. We don't have reunions. We don't put the time into organise catching up with our mates enough. And staying linked to the battalion associations is a great way to do that more. And I think if we got all young soldiers, and I'm assuming Air Force and Navy and different corps will have their own associations that they can stay in touch with or units, but I think this is a fundamental step forward if we can encourage DBA to push everyone on the way out, not just to register with DBA, but to stay linked in with their
battalion association.
Yeah. So how can we do that for anyone listening to this? How can they get more involved with their association?
Look, I think the key. Look, I've just been so impressed with the COs and the RSMs of the battalions. I mean, I attend the Corps conference every year. I'm part of the council, and I think it would be beneficial if the CO through the RSM, more importantly, pushes people, you know, there's got to be some pushes people to join their battalion association on separation. And and the reason is not to spin warriors and get on the piss, you know. The reason is that these battalion associations will keep you in touch. And more importantly, if you have a complaint about something, all they've got to do is put it through their battalion association. The battalion association can put it to me. And if it's a major issue, which quite often they are, we go straight to the top. You know, I mean, I mean, today I sent an email off to Major General Fox. She's now going to be the new Deputy Chief of Army. terrific officer. And I've sent something off to her, and I'll get something back, you know. And it's that sort of chain of command. I mean, we never try to operate outside the chain of command. The only time we operate outside the chain of command if people aren't bloody listening. Then we'll go outside the chain of command. But whilst we have that conduit, and we have a unique position in the ESO community in Australia because the Colonel Commandant is appointed by Chief of Army. The Colonel Commandant is enshrined in our Constitution. And that's why we're very mindful and also respectful of the Army and Chain of Command. So we're very, 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 very careful in terms of how we manage things. But when you're able to send an email off to a senior officer expressing a concern about a particular issue and it's managed or it's dealt with, you know, I mean, that no other ESO has that. And I think that is enough reason for a young person, young male or female soldier to join the battalion association, to have that linkage so that if there is a problem and they're not able to manage, they go through their battalion association, and then the battalion association president just got to get on the phone, talk to me. We can manage stuff.
Yeah, that's great. So you bloody heard it. Go and join your battalion associations and get involved and get your voice heard and then get in part of the chain of command.
Yep.
Mate, so just before we shoot, I just want to say, Trojan's Trek, that's something you're pretty invested in. Did you want to give it a bit of a plug and we can get that out on
social? Absolutely. Trojan's Trek was started by one of my patrol commanders, Bob Carney, who rode Crossfire, and Moose Dunlop, who was one of my classmates at Portsea. Moose got out as a colonel. And they've been running Trojan's Trek here and in Queensland now for probably 15 years, roughly 15 years. And I'll tell you what, it's incredible. I mean, we take maybe a dozen or 15 people up into the bush, no phones, no drugs except prescription drugs, no booze, you know, just living in shearers' quarters. And basically, a bit of a program in terms of, as I've said earlier, talking about their issues. And you've got people around the circle who don't know each other. And at the end of a 6-day period, they're crying and hugging as they say goodbye. And they then become a support group to each other. If they're not traveling too well, get on the phone to a bloke that's in Tasmania or in Townsville. And the success rate is probably about 99.9%. Seriously, we've had such a success with it. It's a separate entity to us. They now have their own DGR status in terms of donations and grants and gifts and all that sort of stuff. But we do one for women now. It's dedicated to women as well. It's a fabulous program. We've had COs actually send some of their trouble diggers onto it, and they've taken some leave, you know. The battalions where they've had some young diggers have had problems have been very, very supportive. We also take, you know, police and AMBOs, but, you know, our primary target is diggers.
Mm-hmm. Mate, sounds like a bloody good initiative, getting people back out and connecting and getting away from all the shit and then finding another tribe to be part of. So we'll get some links up, mate, so people can find that in the show notes.
I can send it to you, Anthony, no problem at all.
Oh, that'd be brilliant, mate. And I just want to say, I don't think we barely, we're just coming up to 90 minutes. I don't think we barely scratched the surface, mate, but we'd love to have you back on and deep dive some of the other things. Especially there's a couple of cheeky questions that the boys have asked. There's two things the boys have asked before you go. Real quick questions. Goff Whitlam, the Goffers are Gumpies. Is that where Goffers come from?
No.
It's called Kansas. No.
Look, to be honest, To be honest, I don't know where Gougher came from. I've got no idea, but it certainly didn't come from Gougher Whitlam.
All right, I don't bugger. Ah, magic, mate. I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope to try and get you back on. And if you're willing, come and talk about some more issues.
Very happy. Anytime. Anytime. All right. I'm going to have a glass of red.
I think I'll have a beer too.
Cheers.